Morning, how you doing?
We're on?
Pretty good.
Morning, everybody. The Senate Education Committee will come to order. Today's Wednesday, February 25, 2015. We have a few bills before us this morning. First is Senate File 334, Senator Johnson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm very excited and a little nervous about bringing this bill forward because it is really, I believe, a kind of a maiden voyage we're going on, looking at comprehensive eye exams for every child who enters our public schools. Senate File 334 is a state screen. It calls for state screening requirements for kindergarten enrollment for a comprehensive eye exam. And as I said, we are on a maiden voyage, but we will be following four states who already have comprehensive screening for their children: Illinois, Kentucky, Missouri, and North Carolina. So if you look at our state laws currently, screening requirements include developmental assessments, a hearing screening, immunizations, and other information which may inhibit a child from learning in school. Senate File 334 is proposing that we include a comprehensive eye exam prior to enrolling in school as part of those requirements. And here is why. My goal in bringing this bill forward is to help children succeed in school. Based on some of the research in your handouts, you can see that more than 80% of learning is attributed to vision. Good eyesight is essential in order for our children to succeed in school. And the many, many articles that I've read discussing this issue would hold up that information. The purpose of the bill is not to take away or criticize the eye screenings which are done in our schools right now. But there are school-age children who have treatable vision or eye health problems that are not always caught by eye screenings. Because they did not get a comprehensive exam at an early age, some of these undiagnosed and untreated problems can lead to early reading challenges or placement in special education programs. Even worse, these vision programs negatively impact childhood development and lead to preventable special education, vocational, and social service all the way into adulthood. Just to clarify, Mr. Chair, I'm not looking to replace eye screenings or to conducting eye exams in schools or add costly, unfunded mandates to school districts. Just like the sample health summary you have in front of you, you have a flyer from the Hermantown School District that shows the health summary form, and families have to fill this out. What we're asking for is an extra line on that health summary form that would say that families filled out after they have received an exam from an ophthalmologist or an optometrist at the doctor's office. This is similar to the parent notification language, which was amended into law several years ago. It did not create added administrative burden on school officials or costs, as far as I know. And speaking of costs, the very good part of this is that the Affordable Care Act now covers the cost of comprehensive eye exams as an essential benefit, so all families who have coverage can get this exam done. Mr. Chair, I have two optometrists here with me to testify in favor of the bill, as well as Beth Coleman, who is here from the Minnesota Optometric Association to answer technical questions.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. And if the testifiers could each state their name for the record.
I'm Dr. Joel Solem from the Lakeville-Apple Valley area.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman and Senators of the Committee, when we discuss eye health care in children, we're looking at vision as a main component. That is what the screenings are looking at now. Is the child able to see the board and see the notes in front of them? There is a large component to eye health care that is not vision related. It's the health of the body and how the health of the eye interweaves with the health of the body. There are a number of studies that look at the prevalence of problems related to health and eye care. Statistics can be as low as 1% or as high as 17% as the amount of health problems that occur in the eye. During these screenings, vision is always looked at. Is the child able to see the letters in front of them? But they are not looking at the health of the internal structures of the eye and how it relates to the child's ability to learn. I want to give you a couple examples in my own practice that I've seen. I had a young man that came into my office. He had very clear vision and passed his screenings. And the only reason he came in when I asked him, "What brings you into my office today?" was he said, "I'm back from college." So this is an older man. And he said, "My mother made me come in just because I've never had an eye exam." He had passed all of his screenings before. When I was evaluating his eyes, they were great. He was able to see all the letters I could put in front of him. His vision was spectacular. However, when I dilated his eyes and looked at the inside of his eyes, he had a hemorrhaging pattern that was very peculiar and unique. Usually, it is a diagnostic factor in leukemia. Immediately, I referred him over to an oncologist, and he began treatment with chemotherapy the very next day. This young man was able to beat this condition, and now I still see him as a patient, and he's running marathons, he's doing very well. But that type of problem in the eyes does not get picked up during a screening. I have another young child that was passed a screening. He was 14. I've had passed every screening that he'd been on. In fact, when he came in, there was three children in the family, and I gave eye exams to mom and dad and the two other children because they had vision problems. They couldn't see very well. And this third child did not have an eye exam scheduled that day, but was just with because the whole family was there. So I suggested, "Well, is it okay if I see this young child?" And the parents said, "Okay, yeah, you can see this child." And the child sat down at the chair and covered an eye, and he read the bottom of line of the chart. And then he covered his other eye and read the same line on the bottom of the chart. Now, I switch my letters with each eye, and he read the same exact letters. And I said, "Well, they're different letters." It turns out that he was blind in that eye, was not able to see, and had been faking it the whole time during all of his screenings because he would just read with his very well-seeing eye in his right eye and then repeat what he saw in his other eye. And at 14, his parents had no idea that he was blind in his left eye because he had never had a comprehensive eye examination. I had another gentleman that was 46. So again, older. Never had a comprehensive eye exam before. He came in because in your mid-40s, you start to lose your ability to read, and reading glasses are oftentimes very important. He was having difficulty with that. During the assessment, when I was talking to him, he had several health conditions. He had infections that would not heal. He had wounds on his body. He had lost several digits, several of his fingers. And as I was evaluating his health, he had a pattern on his eye, on the front of his eye, that was very unique. And I recommended that he go in. I wrote several letters that he had special screening for a condition called Fabry's disease, which is very rare. And his whole life he had had these medical conditions, and his primary care physicians were unable to determine what was going on with it. Now, through a comprehensive eye exam, looking at these patterns, we were able to determine that he had this Fabry's disease and had to have special treatment. I think he is only one of 16 people in the state that has this particular condition. And it was caught during a comprehensive eye exam. Now, again, I'm talking about older people in my clinic. But these conditions may have been caught much earlier. In fact, maybe as a young school-aged child and treated more appropriately during a comprehensive eye exam, caught during a comprehensive eye exam. Now, I've heard several people, as I've been talking about this, discuss that, well, what is one eye exam going to do at such a young age? Just one eye exam. Well, these conditions oftentimes can be caught when a child is very young and treated appropriately so that the child not only has visual health, but also has systemic health throughout their school age. It also will set the precedent of appropriate eye care going forward throughout their life, which is very important to set that precedent. A child that goes in, a parent that brings a child in for dental care before they have their first grade, it sets a precedent of appropriate oral hygiene throughout their life. A comprehensive eye exam at a young age will also set a precedent of appropriate ocular health throughout a child's life, which I believe is very important.
Thank you, Doctor.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mary Gregory. I'm a pediatric optometrist out in Monticello, Minnesota. So I practice in rural community and do routine eye exams on children every day. I think that we're all here certainly to talk about what's most important is that our children in Minnesota. We have one of the top education systems in the nation, and I think we want to continue to push forward to be a leader in our country in our education and in producing educated, productive adults. While I think our education system is doing many things correctly, and clearly that's why we're on the top, I think we're missing a critical component with our vision. Our brain uses our vision more than all the other four senses combined. That's 70% of our brain processing vision. That's huge. That's a huge component to learning, and I think one that is often overlooked. In kindergarten, first grade, we do teach in a multisensory approach, so while we are using vision primarily, we do have other opportunities with our other senses to learn. By second grade, certainly third grade, that's done. And vision is really how we continue to learn moving forward into the future. So right now we're using our vision screenings to determine if a child in fact does have an issue with vision. And these are done by well-trained nurses. I think the screenings are doing a good job. I think they're catching children at a distance. These are educated, well-meaning parents holding a plastic spoon over one eye and having your child read the chart on the board. And the board work was how we used to learn. That's not the case anymore. Technology, where we are right now, my kids are on the iPad program. It's fantastic. We have awesome tools and opportunities, but they're all at a book. They're all on the iPad. They're all on the iPod. They're on the computer. My children's lectures from their teachers, they pull up on the computer, and they're in middle school. So our current screenings are not really looking at kids who can see the board. They're identifying those children, and they're doing a good job at that. They're not identifying problems with learning and reading. And even as adults, we have computer vision stress and eye strain, and we're tired at the end of the day. Imagine being 6 or 5 and now having to make new connections. We're learning. We're using energy to process new information. And we're also trying then to keep our eyes focused up close all day. I have a patient that just stopped in on Monday, and this is a daily occurrence for me. Logan is halfway through first grade. He is on an IEP, I think will soon be in our special education program. He's almost a year behind in his reading, and I will tell you, confidence is affected already then. He thinks he's stupid. He is excited to get to kindergarten. He is excited to learn to read like his older siblings, yet he gets there, and it's not happening. He doesn't understand why the other kids are learning, and he's not. He passed his preschool screening. He passed his pediatrician screening. He passed his first grade vision screening. And he didn't have a problem with seeing the board. He didn't have a problem with seeing up close at the beginning of the day. He came in a couple months ago. I put him in a pair of glasses. He was having struggles containing and maintaining clear focus vision during the day. So we were going to give this a try. He stops in on Monday with his mom. His mom's a little concerned to ask me if he can start wearing his glasses all day. It turns out the glasses don't make the words move on the page, and he had no idea that words, according to his words, are waving at me. That's how he was trying to learn. So our screenings are great, but they're missing those kids, and those kids are in this achievement gap we're worried about. So I believe we're missing the ball on vision. Now, cost has always been an issue. So I think that's always been the main holdback here, and cost certainly was a concern, or we'd have been pushing for mandatory kindergarten eye exams years ago. We live in the United States. We live in the best state. We're in Minnesota, yet we're asking our kids to do a visual education for 12 years, hopefully longer, and we're not checking their eyes by an eye care professional, by somebody who understands vision, understands how vision is part of learning. So school screenings are doing a purpose. They're missing a lot. Now, in our system now, our essential benefits, the national government says vision is important. Of the core things that our children need, anybody 19 years and under, not only do they have one eye exam, they have a yearly covered eye exam by an eye doctor and a pair of glasses. Our children deserve to be able to see to learn. Now, this does not, now, our medical assistance programs have always covered this. MinSure, UCare, Blue Plus, our private insurances. Minnesota is amazing with our insurance coverage. These kids have coverage. We're just not utilizing it, and parents don't know that there's a difference. And let me tell you, they're upset in my exam room when they find out that their child could be reading better, could be not fighting homework, could not be feeling low self-esteem because of a pair of glasses. It's sad. Right now, the kids that I'm worried about are those that are going to be uninsured. And right now, we don't know really where they are or who they are or how many there are. But I think that this requirement will help us define those kids. Those kids are the ones falling through the cracks right now. I think those kids, through our local and state programs, will be taken care of. Kentucky, as Senator Johnson said, kind of went through this back in 2000 already. Not sure how much money it was going to cost to take care of our uninsured kids. It turns out that they don't even put it in their budget anymore, their local and state programs. It just wasn't an issue. So I don't think cost is an issue any longer. My approach with my children and my family is to be proactive and not react with anything, and I would argue that our state needs to take that same approach and to remain a leader in education. Right now, I think we have the knowledge, the resources. We have the second largest number of Fortune 500 companies per capita. That's amazing. We need educated workforce to contain and continue that robust economy, and Minnesota can do that. I think our future, children's future, is important. I think education is key. I think vision is critical to learning. I think that in Minnesota, I know our kids have comprehensive coverage for glasses and an eye exam by an eye care professional who understands. And I think we need to be proactive. I think we need to catch every child, every single one, even if it's 1% or 10%, although I certainly see it much higher than that. Every child deserves the opportunity to see to learn in our state.
Thank you, Dr. Gregory. Quorum is present. Questions of Drs. Solem or Gregory? Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm not sure who to direct this to, but do you pick or can you pick up children that might have dyslexia through a comprehensive
Dr. Gregory?
Eye exam?
You know, and I'm glad that you brought that up. There's a lot of discussion on what really dyslexia is. I think the most common agreed definition is we've got a child with a high IQ and a reading ability that does not match. So there's a mismatch between how they're performing and what we know they're capable of. That mismatch could be due to lots of different things. So dyslexia is a term that everybody kind of falls into that. I think now we're kind of labeling it more as a learning disability, which is where our children are being put into the IEPs and special ed programs right now, as they have some type of a learning issue. I would certainly say that our brain processes our vision intensely, and so certainly there are learning problems that are being misdiagnosed or mislabeled maybe as an attention issue. If you can imagine, your vision is clear sometimes and blurry sometimes. Now, kindergarten words are big. Third grade, the font gets smaller. We take pictures away, and we've got a lot of words on a page. If your two eyes are both looking, if the words are shaking a little bit, if they're blurry a little bit, and it comes and goes, certainly you're not up on your fluency. Your comprehension isn't there. You're putting your energy into seeing the page, not thinking about what you're reading. And that will affect how you learn. And that will affect or possibly get that child moved into some type of a learning issue or concern. So whether, you know, I wouldn't say it's dyslexia, but certainly, right. Yeah, an eye exam is going to pick all of those things up. Routine eye care by an eye doctor is going to determine that.
Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, doctors, for being with us. A question I have, given the current system that we have in our schools for vision screening, do you have a professional organization that has done any study about how many referrals come to ophthalmologists in the state, and maybe a little bit of your personal history on receiving referrals coming to you through the vision screening, current vision screening process?
Identify yourself for the record.
This is Dr. Joel Solm. I do not believe in the state of Minnesota there is a study that talks about referral numbers. But there have been studies that have been done in other states that talk about the referral numbers. And if I'm remembering the study correctly, it was 58% of children that had visual problems were detected by the screening in this particular study. And it was...
Can I speak to this?
Yes.
Sorry, this is Dr. Gregory. There are many evidence-based studies. There are many people who look at these numbers. It's hard to put together a full comprehensive study on this topic. I will say the numbers come from different sources, and they range anywhere from 10 to 30%. We do have a practice out in the St. Cloud area. Four doctors, they've got a residency program. For the last 5 years, they've been going into the schools themselves and doing eye exams on kids. So this past year, they just completed this not even a month ago. They saw 1,058 first graders. They failed 46% of them based on an eye exam. They went in and did a full comprehensive eye exam on these children in the school. 46% failed. So the statistics and the other research and numbers show anywhere from 10 to 30%. In my personal practice, in my area, the nurses at the school and at the doctor's office, they want kids to come see me. They understand that they're only doing a small part of this. I don't see a lot of referrals based on a screening. I see a lot of kids with issues that pass the screening. So, and I see that every day. It is much higher than 10% of these kids are falling through the cracks. So that's my day.
Thank you. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm in an unusual situation where there's an ophthalmologist in my district who is recovering from heart surgery, so he wanted to be here to express concerns, and so he's asked me to be his voice. So I say this not standing here opposing the bill, but just sharing that he asked me to express some concerns, and I'd be interested in your thoughts about this. His view was that that the best possible thing we could do would be to invest in what he calls the serial practice of vision screening that happens at the regular checkups that happen, because they happen over many different points in time. And so this ophthalmologist feels as though putting our investment into looking at one point in time whereby all children have to have this, rather than bolstering up the partnership that the Department of Health has with the practitioners in the field to do this on a regular basis, and then providing more education to professionals to be able to spot check when things are, you know, amiss, is his preference. He was concerned that if we were to move forward with this approach, that we would be, in fact, doing some damage in terms of walking away from the importance of the regular eye exams that happen in daily or annual checkups.
This is Dr. Gregory. I think that's a valid a point to bring up, and I'm glad that you did. We're asking our pediatricians who do a course in vision to then be able to do a comprehensive eye exam. So they're going to miss the same things. The increasing problem with pediatricians right now is that they're being asked to do so many things in a shorter amount of time. And that's healthcare and that's insurance reimbursement. They have less and less time to do a head-to-toe evaluation of your child. Our local pediatrician sends all of his babies to me at 6 months for a check already. He sends them to me at 3 and at kindergarten. So we are taking it out of the place of somebody who's not trained in vision and actually taking it at least once to have one comprehensive eye exam for every child. Should they have more? Yes. Will they get more education about that? Will the awareness that's out there that children need to have vision care? I think just even that one comprehensive eye exam is going to spread that word. So I don't believe that serial care is going to change. I think vision needs more education with every family practitioner and pediatrician in that in those well-child visits. It needs to be on their form. They're asking, are you wearing a helmet? Are you putting your seatbelt on? We're not asking, have you had your eyes checked? It seems a little backwards to me. So I don't think that that's really a valid concern.
Thank you.
Can I add a little bit? This is Dr. Joel Solem again.
Doctor.
We have, in the state, it's in the country, we have a large army of eye care professionals already trained and prepared for this, of optometry and ophthalmology, to handle this. To go back and retrain all of the pediatricians to give a comprehensive eye exam, to look for some of these problems in focusing and eye alignment and retinal health and ocular health, when we already have a system in place with optometry and ophthalmology to do these comprehensive eye exams, I think it would cost more to go back and train the pediatricians to give these examinations at 3 months of age and at 3 years of age and at 6 years of age along their course of their pediatricians.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for that. And I just want to clarify, he was not advocating for that. He was advocating for making sure that pediatricians and school personnel knew to look for the signs that those kids should be referred to the ophthalmologist. He believes, as you do, that they're the most qualified to do that. Thank you.
Noted, Senator Johnson. And then I think we're going to hear from opponents or persons with some questions.
Views.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members, first of all, I'm very happy to see that Commissioner Caselius is sitting in on this subject, because I know that she's been a leader in education in trying to deal with the achievement gap and graduation rate, which calls for keeping kids in school. And I'll tell you, when they don't see very well after they get to be about fifth grade, they kind of let you know that they aren't going to hang around very long, very successfully. Also, I have the hope that that the commissioners from health and human services and education can come together and collaborate and make this something that happens quickly and good. So I'm happy to see her here today. Secondly, I just wanted to tell you, I have so many stories to tell. First of all, my own personal story. I have one grandchild and two great-grandchildren of ours who are going to have vision exams because of this bill. Three out of my family that I've said, you know what, I'll take care of this for each one of you kids, because I'm going to make sure that it isn't your vision that's causing you some of the issues that you are being challenged with in your families. Secondly, I have to tell you one more that I have permission to give it. And that was when former Representative Peg Larson came into my office to talk to me about charter school legislation. And then I got onto vision, which I often do whenever I meet with anyone in my office. And she said, you know, I didn't know I couldn't see until I went to had my driver's exam at age 16. And she said that the most, the key thing she said to me that hits me and keeps me informed about her, she said, I wonder what I would have been. And now she's a former legislator, she's a lobbyist, she's done well in her life, I would say, as a person who looks at her, but who knows what's inside of her. How many people, I've had the Department of Education people, the Department of Health people, I've talked to them, and they will tell me about instances that are very similar. Yes. My own similar, my own brothers and sisters, we have eye issues in our family that we didn't discover oftentimes until later. But
thank you, Senator Johnson.
And my testifiers. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctors Solomon Gregory, and if you'll stand by in event of eventual
follow-up here.
There are at least four individuals that have asked to testify. I'll ask as many of you that can fit at the table to join us. We would like to wrap up by no later than 9:20 on this, as we have a number of other items, and of course we can take this up at another meeting as well if we don't have enough time. Welcome, Dr. Botham.
Thank you. My name is Eric Botham. I am a pediatric ophthalmologist. I am an associate professor at the university in the Department of Ophthalmology, Visual Neurosciences, and Pediatrics. I grew up in Minnesota. My dad was an elementary school teacher. My wife taught first grade for a while. And certainly spent about 13 years past high school to do what I do, which is to love caring for kids' eyes. I see kids every day, both clinically and surgically caring for them in whatever our capacity. But I also love trying to do it better. And that's why I'm at the university. Multi-center trials and all kinds of evidence-based things are what we do to try to help children 10 years from now have better outcomes than we do now. I have great pride in working at probably the biggest pediatric eye care clinic in the in Minnesota, the Minnesota Lions Children's Eye Clinic, and I'm the director there. So I love this subject. It's a wonderful subject. And I love that there's so much passion in the state to do this better. Catch kids better, treat kids better. It's an exciting time. I enjoyed having Alice Johnson visit my clinic last year and connecting. I certainly share excitement about her passion and trying to catch the kids that are the most challenged, and especially from a learning perspective. I disagree with her approach and in terms of this particular bill and shifting what I think we have as a screening system and a support net that's strong that can continue to get better to in a different direction. But I do appreciate the passion she has. I was wondering, because I think we live in a society where science gets tuned out because of testimony. You look at this last week, month, whatever it is, and look at the viber, the tenor in the national media over vaccines. And yet I don't think too many people in the room are going to say we should get rid of vaccinating kids, but yet the testimony of a few gets listened to very strongly. In the same way, we have kids that still we're needing to catch better, work on better, whatever it is, and we need to make the systems better to, you know, isolate those kids, catch them, get them treatment. But we have to be careful that the 80%, 90%, 70%, whatever studies you want to use, of the kids that are normal, we're not putting them through undue burden and directing healthcare costs in a way that could be better used for kids that actually have the problems. So why is it that the U.S. Preventative Service Task Force, why is it the American Academy of Ophthalmology, eye doctors and ophthalmologists, why is it the American Academy of Pediatrics, why is it the Association for Orthoptists who deal with specialists at eye alignment, school nurses, Lions, why do so many people defend, devote their lives championing screening programs? Because they work. The Minnesota Department of Health knows it. They invest in it. They have a passion for it. And the evidence is behind it that it works. And there are tools that continue to make it better. We hear testimonies of people coming in when they're 17 or 42 at any age with a new condition or a condition maybe that's been there for a while, and isolating any
focusing too much attention on any one age, I think derails from the opportunity we have to catching them in a screening program that continues to reinforce. Sensitivity. Some studies say maybe screening is a 90% success rate. Comprehensive eye exams is not perfect either. There are kids that get missed with comprehensive eye exams. That's not a perfect sensitivity either. But even if you have a screening program, 90% success rate, what's the chance that a healthy child that's never had any eye problems, never had symptoms, no learning disabilities, nothing, fail a screening? It might be 10%. Well, we're doing it again a year later. That's what the Minnesota Department of Health recommends. Kindergarten, first grade, third grade, fifth grade, seventh grade, 10th grade. What's the chance that the same screening program misses the same kid twice? That's 10.1 times 0.1, or 10 times 10 is 1 in 100. What's the chance that a screening program misses the same kid three times? We're talking 1 in 1,000. Screening works, but it takes a very critical piece that says, if you have a condition that could be related to your eyes, if you have a concerned parent that just wants an exam, if you have any sort of eye disease or medication or any syndrome that might be related to eye health, those kids are supposed to be getting eye exams. I'm happy that Logan was in the office we just heard about and in a kindergarten age or first grade age. Why? Because he has a learning disability and deserves an eye exam, and he's getting one. We're not talking about children with symptoms not having eye exam, because the system's already there to pay for that, as we have on a national level a mandate to encourage. The question is, do you send all the rest of them in? And that comes back to, are we missing kids? What's the sensitivity and what's the prevalence of disease? We hear all sorts of things, and yet I would ask people to look at the literature that I'd say is quite deep. The American Academy of Ophthalmology looks at the things that we want to catch in preschoolers. Amblyopia, lazy eye stuff, refractive error. Risk of amblyopia, 3%. Risk of strabismus, misalignment, 3%. We can use the optometric literature just last month in the American Academy of Optometry. What's the prevalence of amblyopia? Lazy eye, one eye being a little weaker. Nothing's wrong with the other eye. The other eye can read. But that's 2%. Misalignment issues at this age, 2.1 to 3.6%. Refractive error. What's the chance they need glasses and haven't already been picked up? Who knows what that is, but just all of them at that age, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, 5 to 7%. We're talking numbers that are less than 10% of the population, so 90% by evidence-based literature would support are doing fine. And the added piece is, I'm a pediatric ophthalmologist. I treat all kinds of things. I'm one of the busiest pediatric cataract surgeons in the upper Midwest. What's the average age of a cataract that I see? 6 months? Maybe even less than that for some kids. My colleague Jill Anderson is a specialist with eye cancer, retinoblastoma. Those kids are picked up in the first year of life, 2 years of life, pediatric glaucoma, alignment issues. There are so many kids that don't even get to age 4 before they're already in our clinics. So the sense that there is even a population like this that hasn't been seen yet that has silent symptoms is really an exaggeration. Number two, even if there's an eye problem that's there, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a learning challenge or disability because of it. This is a hard issue, and I would encourage anyone that really wants to understand these terms, learning disability, dyslexia, Google learning disability and the AAP, the American Academy of Pediatrics. You'll get a joint statement that's fairly current, easy to read, goes over hundreds of articles that have looked at the relationship between vision and learning disability. And the answer at the fine print at the bottom is it's pretty darn weak. So to suggest that learning disabilities are there because of eye problems is really a stretch of what we would know in the literature. So risk of eye disease is low. Current safety net is high. Learning-related challenges, I think people can debate and continue to do. And it's because of that that we continue to screen kids again and again and again to catch them with sensitivity that works. And I have one, it's interesting. You wonder how many evidence-based large trials we need to present to say what we do in the Minnesota Department of Health works. What we do in Minnesota works. One of them just came out. It's the Department of Health and Human Resources at the on a national level put together a committee, and they wanted to know how do we catch kids. The title of that committee, there was the National Center for Children's Vision and Eye Health, and they did a mountain of work also reviewing all the literature and how we detect eye disease in kids. This article describes the best practices supported by available research. It was published in the American Academy of Optometry, not ophthalmology, optometry. And the title, Vision Screening for Children 36 to 72 Months, Recommended Practices. Substantial evidence has accumulated. It's there are people on all fronts caring for kids' eyes support vision screening. And the question is, do we invest in a system that would sink significant healthcare funds that can go to a lot of ways, and one age group has already been brought up, knowing that many of the kids are already caught, and many of the kids that are age 4, even if they pass, can still have their eyes shift, develop nearsightedness. I got mine when I was 5 or 5th grade. I didn't need glasses when I was in 1st grade. Things continue to change, and that's why our programs continue to screen. And if there's ever a symptom, they get an exam. If they ever fail screening, they get an exam. And the best part about it, and the part that I would just ask patience on, is how we are doing it better. Right now, there's a task force. I was involved in 2006 in our Minnesota Department of Health on a task force to make sure we're doing vision screening the best way possible. We want to catch every kid that could have anything related to visual health. And yet, the technology gets better. We have more and more studies that say, don't test them at this distance, test them closer. And we're continuing to figure out ways to catch them. But not only that, technology gets better. Little cameras like this. Looks like a camera. It's not a camera. It's an automated visual screener. There's all kinds of different technologies like this coming available. Point it out of child's face. You push the button, and in seconds, it gives you, number one, prompt to detect ocular alignment issues. Number two, it detects if there's some sort of vision problem, that blurred axis. And number three, it tells you even a glasses prescription. But it's you don't even need to know the facts because it says pass or fail. $3,000 for one of these. Put them in every pediatrician's office, every school in the state. Wow. I showed this to Alice last week. I was really excited about your response.
Couldn't do it, work it.
She said, I wish I would have known 6 months ago.
I said you couldn't make it work.
No, we got it. The pupils were too small because the lights were on in the room in front of her big window. So you, truly though, but my challenge is, even if it doesn't work in one exam room with the lights on, what does the literature show? They work. They work. And the excitement is, at a time when the Minnesota Department of Health is reconvening the committee right now, nothing to do with this policy question, they're reconvening the committee because they want to say, maybe we should be using these, maybe we use something else, whatever it is. It's an exciting time, and the systems of catching kids get better and better and better. And so invest in, what is a history? Invest in why, in programs that so many organizations across the country know work, and then give opportunities for those programs to get better. Ophthalmologists, pediatricians, healthcare providers that work in our programs like we have here at the state have passions for screening because they know we catch kids. I'm going to go to work this afternoon. I'm going to see a lot of kids before they're fourth grade or 4 years old because they've been screened and caught early. I'm going to see kids that are in school with vision-related learning challenges and try to care for the kids, but I'm going to see a lot of normal kids. The people just wondered if there's a vision problem and don't. Please help us to continue invest in catching kids, but please have great caution before mandating this sort of exam on kids that have healthy eyes.
Thank you, Dr. Bothoon. And members, I apologize that we have such an ambitious agenda with so much to review, and we have a major report on Indian education from that work group and dyslexia their day at the Capitol. And Senator Johnson, what I'd like us to do is to ask the next three testifiers to summarize in a 1 minute each their concerns, because we will lay this over and then bring it up after there's been a further vetting of any of these issues. So, Ms. Dosland, Sandvig, and Kelleher, if you could please proceed that way, and then we'll lay it over and bring it up at a subsequent meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dosland, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Family and Early Education. MNAFI is the first stop in early childhood screening. They are the screeners that do early childhood screening. And I want to just bring us back to the topic content of the particular bill, which MNAFI has concerns about. Early childhood screening is required to be done by the time a child enters kindergarten. School districts start to screen at age 3, and they can screen through age 5. While I commend Senator Johnson for her goal, I don't think that this bill does that. I've heard that we have to start somewhere. We do start somewhere with early childhood screening. A vision screening is a required component of early childhood screening, and if a child is determined to have visual problems, they are referred to through early childhood screening to see an optometrist or an ophthalmologist. Last year, almost 59,000 children were screened through just early childhood screening. 3,500 were sent for referred to other services. So just also some logistical concerns that we have about the bill. A child has to be screened before they enter kindergarten. If a child does not have a comprehensive eye exam, they cannot start kindergarten. There's a lot of, if a parent has a child screened at age 3, they have to prove upon kindergarten entrance that they've had the screening. What happens if they've lost the documentation? Some other things, the way our early childhood screeners looked at the bill was this is a required component of early childhood screening. They've read it that they have to assure that they have an optometrist or an ophthalmologist there at the time of screening to provide the screening exam. That's quite expensive. It's already would be added onto a cost for early childhood screening that school districts currently don't get fully reimbursed for. And while we commend Senator Johnson's goal, what I've heard today is not about children age 3 to age 5. I've heard about fifth graders and 16-year-olds. And we think that early childhood screening is the first step in a process to look for eye problems, but that it's not. This bill does not provide the solution to the long-term problem we're hearing about.
Thank you, Ms. Dosland. Ms. Sandvig?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Linda Sandvig. I'm here on behalf of the School Nurse Organization of Minnesota. And many of the concerns we share with the same that Ms. Dosland talked about. We want to bring it back to what the bill does, and it's amending the preschool screening, the early screening process. So we are focusing on the very young. As she indicated, we have about a 6% referral rate based on vision. We also, when we look at preschool screening, we're looking at many other things. We're looking at physical exam. We're looking at social, emotional. We're looking at coordination and things like that. Nothing in screening looks at examination. So it's all of a thing looking as far as what are the problems and what are the referrals that we can do as far as into the community in looking at that. That would deal with vision screening. That would deal with physical examinations, dental type of things. We do not require before kids come to school that they have a physical examination, a dental. And believe me, I'm hearing a lot of things about dental.
Okay.
So we would just look as far as keeping with the screening in looking at this. And a comprehensive exam, we think we'll be spending a lot of time trying to do either documentation to look at something that we feel that we are addressing in screening. And just one more quick thing is I have talked to Senator Johnson. We do think that there's some programs out there that would address this issue better. For example, in Minneapolis and St. Paul, they're working with Phillips Eye Institute. What they found is in the vision screening, when the school districts had to cut back as far as vision, that even after they did the screening, that the referrals weren't being picked up. So only 25% of the referrals, even when free care was offered, were not being taken advantage of. So with providing transportation, translation, on-site services, they've been able to address those issues. So we think there's other ways to address this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Kelleher, 1 minute, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to stick to the 1 minute. We do have concerns about this bill going forward. School districts, as you've heard, due to our early childhood screenings, of which we are not fully reimbursed. So this would add
more cost as well as a new mandate going forward. I'd like to draw the committee's attention down to 1.6 through 1.20. This is language on this vision group that they've brought forward to encourage referrals already, and they must have not gotten the answer they wanted, so they're back for another round. We certainly understand vision is important, but it's something we do all throughout school. It's not a one-time chance. And I think we do a pretty good job of it, Mr. Chairman, and I would really encourage you to not support the bill.
Okay. Thank you to each of the testifiers and for others. We will visit this subject again. And Senator Johnson, a concluding remark, and then we're going to lay it over.
Mr. Chair, there is an awful lot of discussion that has gone on already with this bill. It I know needs more discussion, and I am willing and ready to deal with especially the early childhood screening. I don't see this as a – I see this as an addition to the childhood screening, because if they screen at age 3 and then refer the child to a optometrist or an ophthalmologist, that they would then still be looking at what was going on with the people. Okay. And then at age 5 or whenever they enter kindergarten or public school, they would have to be show to the school that they have had a comprehensive eye exam.
Okay.
I am willing to work with it and appreciate the interest of the committee to this issue. Some of my statistics, I'll just give you the two really
critical Johnson,
ones.
Very briefly, because we're...
Okay. 1 in 4 children are said to have vision problems, and 7 of 10 juvenile delinquents are said to have vision problems. Is there a correlation, especially with the juvenile delinquents? Is there a correlation? I think we need to find out about that. Thank you.
Thank you. And there is a pending fiscal note. We'll await that and additional input. Thank you, Senator Johnson. Senate File 334 will be laid over. Next, we have a report, the Indian Education Working Group. Thank you for your patience to everyone here for that. And we'll, as the room partially clears on the for Senate 334, we'll ask Commissioner Casellas and testifiers as allows to join you at the table, and we'll get the AV set up. So we'll resume in 1 minute. Okay, and if someone could please get the door.
The door coming and going.
Okay, welcome back, Commissioner Casellas.
Mr. Chair, committee members, is this on? Can you hear me?
It could be better.
It doesn't sound like it's on.
Bring it closer.
A little closer.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for having us here today. Today is a historic day. I believe we will remember this day today as the day we all came together in partnership with our 11 tribal leaders, key stakeholders, and Minnesotans to say that the current state of Indian education in Minnesota is unacceptable, and that significant effort and resources will be required so that we do not lose a generation of American Indian students. Today we bring bold recommendations that will impact the nearly 20,000 Native students in our state who for too long have been forgotten and left behind. With your help, we can provide targeted support along with accountability across our entire state and positively and quickly change this troubling reality. Our Minnesota Constitution compels us to provide a uniform system of public schools and public education for all of Minnesota students. Yesterday, I spoke about equity and excellence being front and center in our vision, and today we are here to bring forward recommendations so that we can be sure that we have an equitable and excellent education for our Indian students. Let's fulfill our promise of an excellent education for our Native children and all the children of Minnesota. I'd like to introduce Dennis Olson, who is our Director of Indian Education, so that he could bring you through where we're at with the state of Indian education in Minnesota, and then halfway through the PowerPoint, I will convene the recommendations of the 11 tribal leaders, myself, and other key leaders within state government. This is part of our consultation policy that was passed in 2013 in order to better partner with our 11 American Indian communities.
Thank you, Commissioner, and welcome, Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and thank you for the opportunity, like Commissioner Casilius said, to bring the issues and deliver the state of Indian education here in Minnesota to the Senate committee. It's a phenomenal opportunity, and before I get started, I want to first recognize all of our tribal leaders that we have in the room today, our tribal government representatives, our Indian education directors, community members, our elders, of course, our students. Unfortunately, this screen is blocking some of our Indian education students, our American Indian students here from the Bloomington Public Schools. But most importantly, I want to recognize all of those that have come before me that have allowed me the opportunity here to present this information today. They've really laid the foundation and built the opportunity that I'm here to offer. So with that, I want to present briefly a foundation of Indian education in Minnesota, a story of hope. Starting off, I want to just make sure the membership is aware that we have 11 distinct sovereign tribal nations here in Minnesota. We have 7 Ojibwe communities, as well as 4 Dakota communities here in Minnesota, all with their own individual tribal governments and tribal laws. This map shows where our 11 tribal communities are located here in Minnesota. You can see in the northern northwest part of the state, we have our largest 3 communities, the White Earth Nation, the Red Lake Nation, and the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, as well as the Boys Fort Band, the Grand Portage Band, Fond du Lac Band, Mille Lacs Band, and then our upper, lower Sioux, Shakopee, Mdewakanton Sioux community, and the Prairie Island Dakota community. Where are American Indian students concentrated here in the state? This map is from Mr. Fred Nolan from the Minnesota Rural Education Association, MREA. And unfortunately, I didn't provide the key that kind of gives a distinction of what these colors really mean. But the darkest areas, so from brown, red, next to the orangish color, yellow, are our highest concentration of American Indian students. So you can see where I referenced the 3 largest tribal nations in Minnesota. We have a large concentration of American Indian students in that area, as well as the northeast tip of the state there in Cook County, right around St. Louis County and the Duluth Cloquet area. And of course, those are all synonymous with our where our tribal nations are located. You'll see the Twin Cities metro area as well. And I'll get to where or how many students we have in the Twin Cities metro, but a very high concentration here as well is greater Minnesota. So as Commissioner Casilius mentioned, we have nearly 20,000 American Indian students in our K-12 public schools. Represents about 2.3% of our total student population. We have 1/3 of our American Indian students right here in the 7-county metro area, and another 2/3 of our American Indian students that attend public school in greater Minnesota. We also have 4 tribal schools in Minnesota. About 800, a little over 800 students attend those 4 Bureau of Indian Education funded schools. We have a school in the Fond du Lac, or the Fond du Lac Band, a BIE school in the Mille Lacs Band, Circle of Life Academy in the White Earth Nation, and the Bugganegijik School in Leech Lake. We also have a lot of American Indian students in our charter school system as well. We've seen some great successes lately and gains with our graduation rates for American Indian students. When I started my position a little over 2.5 years ago, unfortunately, we had the black eye in the state of being 50th out of 50 for graduating American Indian students in the nation. Minnesota was at the absolute bottom of the barrel with 42% of our American Indian students graduating on time. We've since seen an increase with release of graduation rates yesterday of a little over 8 points in 3 years. It's an incredible increase, but we still feel that there's a lot of work left to do because we're not growing quick enough and we're not getting at the attack of the achievement gap like we absolutely need to with urgency. A little bit of history of Indian education here in Minnesota. Many of you know, but many of you may not know, that it dates back to actually the 1930s. And in the 1950s, the legislature appropriated money for scholarships for American Indian students. All the way through the 1970s, following on the tales of the civil rights movement, American Indian issues, particularly American Indian education issues, were elevated. I had an opportunity last night at the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe Legislative Dinner to speak with the first American Indian Education Director at the Department of Education. There's a long history there. The National Indian Education Association actually started right here in Minneapolis. You'll see at the bottom of the screen, in 1982, the State Board of Education at the time actually issued and adopted a policy statement on Indian education. That policy statement's up on the presentation for you, but a key point, a couple of points there, is that in 1982, so since 1982, the state has recognized self-determination and wanted to ensure the maximum participation by Indian people and by tribes in the education of American Indian students in the state. The state recognizes the unique sovereign status and relationship with the federal government, but the state board at the time also urged the legislature to do the same, directed the commissioner to take a leadership role in meeting the educational needs, recommended districts to do the same, high involvement of tribes and communities, and bottom is most important, a high commitment to incorporate language, culture, and heritage into the curriculum for American Indian students. So this is in 1982. We fast forward, there were a couple of needs assessments done, and in 1988, actually, the Indian Education Act state legislation was passed. And again, there was a needs assessment done in the mid-90s. The Indian Education Act was amended. And in 2000, grant programs were combined to create what we now know today as the Success for the Future state-funded Indian Education Grant. In 2002, unfortunately, due to a large state budget deficit, three Indian education offices, two field offices, one located in Bemidji and the other located in Duluth, were unfortunately consolidated in Roseville. It had detrimental effects in how we perform technical assistance and training to our public school districts and how we serve American Indian students in the state. The Indian Education Act leads off with this paragraph, and I won't read it all, but a couple of key points. It says the legislature recognizes the unique and educationally and culturally related academic needs of American Indian people. These programs are specifically designed to meet these unique educational or culturally related needs, or both. That's important, and that's referenced not only throughout our state legislation, but also federal Indian education legislation, that culturally related and academic needs need to be married. You cannot separate the two in order to see success with American Indian students. Currently, we operate quite a few programs out of the Office of Indian Education. The most prominent is our Success for the Future grants, which we currently fund 32 school districts in the state, and it is a competitive grant process. We also administer the Minnesota Indian Teacher Training Program, an appropriation that goes to four school districts partnered with four higher education institutions. We provide some funding for our four BIE schools through Tribal School Equalization Formula, as well as tribal early childhood family education programs. We also administer the Ethel Curry American Indian Leadership Scholarship, which was a bequeathment from Miss Ethel Curry to provide higher education opportunities for American Indian students. We've seen a lot of success recently with our Success for the Future Indian Education grant programs. We looked at our last six-year funding cycle and compared our Success for the Future districts that we currently fund, again, 32, to our school districts that receive federal Indian education dollars. So there are about 66 of those districts. So we don't even fund half of those who receive federal Indian education dollars. We compared the two groups and see that in 2012, over an 8-point difference in graduation rates for our school districts that we fund with state Indian education funds. You'll see in 2013, almost a 6-point difference there in graduation rates with our funded districts in the state. As an example, here's one of our school districts that's absolutely getting it done when you talk about closing the achievement gap. This is our St. Louis County School District in ISD 2142. They have a focus specifically on math proficiency. They have math coaches in all of their buildings and focus on cognitively guided instruction. Math instruction with a really specific cultural focus. They also focus heavily on post-secondary preparation, concurrent enrollment, and career preparation. They also have a high focus on attendance and support through mentors with the Check and Connect student engagement model. One piece, I won't show you all the data, but you can see those gaps are pretty much closed there in the school district with their Indian students compared to non-Indian students in the district. All of their students met a graduation rate in 2014 of 89.87%. The American Indian students in that district, 91.3%, attributed to the success of the Success for the Future program.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. And I'm going to turn it back over, Mr. Chair, if I'm able to Commissioner Casilius, who's going to talk a little bit again about our commitment to tribal consultation, as well as this process working through our working group recommendations.
Thank you. Mr. Olson?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, and thank you, Dennis, for that really great overview. I also have another sheet that I wanted to have your committee committee administrators help you see just a little bit about our Success for the Future in Cloquet and Detroit Lakes and some of the results that they're getting compared to what we're getting statewide. As you see in the maps that Dennis presented, we have Indian children across the entire state and in smaller populations, 10 in a school or 20 in a school. When you have just 20,000 American Indian students, obviously they're in many, many of our schools across the entire state. And we want to be able to really think about how do we have a statewide strategy to really impact American Indian education and their achievement. And it's going to take a broader effort than just being in 32 schools or concentrating the effort into one key area. It's going to take multiple strategies, and so we wanted to present you with a couple of examples of districts that are doing it in their schools and getting results through our Success for the Future program. As you are aware, through the governor's recommendations, we are asking for an increase in the Success for the Future program. But today I'm going to bring you other recommendations through consultation with the tribal leaders and other key educational leaders within their tribal governments and the government-to-government recommendations that will be brought forward here. I will be sharing these recommendations with the governor as well, but we're going to be sharing them right now. So the governor asked me to convene this group because it's an ongoing effort of multiple efforts that we've been doing over the past 4 years to rebuild our trust and relationship with the American Indian leaders and community. And so in 2011, we had a listening session where we were very respectful in asking, what is it that you want to see happen and what can we do differently to be impactful and how can we partner in a meaningful way with you to make a difference through our self-determination policies that we've had. We held a governor's summit on Indian education in 2012, in which the governor came and listened and greeted the group. In 2013, we added language in our bill about consultation to codify the importance of consulting and partnering with the tribal leaders in order to have really meaningful recommendations that we brought forward. And then in 2013, we required agencies to engage, and the governor then put together training for agencies on government-to-government relations. And then just now, I will talk to you about our recommendations. So this has not been just something that we have just started recently. This has been over the past 4 years, we've been building and cultivating relationships to get to this point where in my opening comments, I think this is a historic day. This is a day where we can come together to really make a difference for our American Indian children. So the first recommendation that's being brought forward today for the group is that we support the governor's recommendation on the Success for the Future to expand from 32 schools to 66 schools, that all schools receive the funding who are Title IV recipients. The working group also recommends, because of the sparsity that happens out in rural Minnesota, we know from Fred's data that of the 17 highest poverty schools in rural Minnesota, 15 have high concentrations of American Indian students. And so these two equity pieces are going hand in hand. And we support the recommendation of $7.5 million annually to support all districts provided through the Success for the Future and expanding those efforts for mentoring and academic supports that we saw in Cloquet and in St. Louis County and in Detroit Lakes and those same kind of practices. So learning from the best and the best practices happening and create opportunity to be able to do that. Secondly, as you may have seen in the Ms. Dribb, the deplorable conditions of the BIE school. I know Senator Bonhoff has been doing some work with the construction of the building. But what was a surprise to me was that I knew there was equalization aid for these four schools, but what I didn't know was how underfunded they were from the federal government. So the federal government funds the schools at approximately about $5,000 per pupil. Our Minnesota kids get about $10,700 per pupil. And for me, this was just jaw-breaking. I mean, I can hardly even talk about it, that they get about half the funding that a normal Minnesota student would get, an average Minnesota student would get. And I just couldn't believe the federal government hadn't seen that and stepped up. So every year we've been doing increases. They haven't been getting those same increases because they're a federally funded BIE school. And because our equalization aid had a cap to it, they could only have a cap up to $1,500. So not only are they going to school in buildings that are not appropriate, but they are also underfunded for basic technology needs, paying teachers, textbooks, all of the things that they need to be able to have an equal education. And so this was very troubling to me, and it would cost about $2.23 million in 16 and $2.76 million to equalize that funding and remove the cap. So that's a recommendation for our 837 students who attend BIE schools. We also, recommendation three, are asking for $1.6 million annually to create new early childhood tribal communities so that they have ECFE funding that's similar to what other district schools are able to have with ECFE funding. Working group recommendation four is that they have the necessary funds to hold harmless our current funding level of the White Earth Race to the Top Transformation Zone. As you know, in the governor's budget, we funded the NAS in St. Paul Promise neighborhood, and we want to be sure that the White Earth Race to the Top Transformation Zones are also held harmless and that those students who have received those scholarships are able to continue in that program. Recommendation five is to examine the current Minnesota charter school statute. It becomes very difficult in our tribal communities to create board composition, and so we wanted to have greater flexibility in the board compositions within tribal communities for charter schools. Recommendation number six is to create a provision which allows Minnesota schools to recognize additional alternative high school equivalency test options at the GED. Tribal leaders brought this as a significant concern to me, as did other, for instance, African-American community brought this as a concern. The GED has gotten more challenging and difficult, and because of that, people are not attempting it. And because we tried to, for the year before it got more difficult and they changed their standards, we did a huge rush for people to take the GED, so we think that's kind of depressed the numbers on the GED. But we want to be able to allow sovereign nations to choose other high school equivalency tests, such as the HISEP. So there are some other products other than just GED that determine high school equivalency, and this is a recommendation brought forward. Working group recommendation number seven is to amend the language in the Indian Education Act of 1988 to strengthen the roles and responsibilities of Indian Education Parent Advisory Groups. This would marry to our consultation policies that we have passed in 2013, and then for accountability purposes, if new dollars are allocated, tie it to the achievement gap portions within the World's Best Workforce Plan. As you know, I'm trying to get the World's Best Workforce Plan to be one plan. It's the strategic plan for the district and trying to link everything to that plan so that the school districts don't have to keep turning in all these different plans for things, and that's the place and the lever for accountability for school districts. And so I would say align all of this new money and new effort right to their curriculum plans, their teacher evaluation, their teacher recruiting plans and prep plans and curriculum plans and the way that they're delivering Indian education through their Success for the Future grants. Right in the accountability into their World's Best Workforce Plan. So that makes a lot of sense to me. There's been a lot of people who have traveled a long way to talk to you today, and I wanted to be brief in my comments. So I want to introduce some of those folks who are here and will testify in front of you today. Joan Lavoie, Indian Director for White Earth Nation. Chairwoman Visner wanted to be here, but she's in D.C. advocating on behalf of Indian communities. Suzanne Wise, Commissioner of Education from the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, is here as well today, representing Chairwoman Melanie Benjamin. And Rocky Pasadora is here today, school board chair from the Bug School. And then we have the kids from Bloomington. Want to thank them as well. And then we have several other directors and Indian education leaders here as well who may also testify. So I want to thank you again for having us here with this hearing. This is an incredible day and an incredible opportunity for Minnesota.
Thank you, Commissioner and Mr. Olson. We'll ask the next three testifiers to come up. And then it would be great if the tribal leaders could maybe all be behind you and offer, following these three presentations, just to offer some statements. And then if the students, we could perhaps conclude with them, and if they could all stand behind you following that segment, and if anyone wants to offer a statement, particularly on this message of hope, hearing from students would be a good way to remind us of why we're here. So,
thank you, Mr. Thank Chair. You. I'll be back.
Senator Claussen, as we're transitioning here.
Yeah, just a quick question, perhaps, from the commissioner.
And as the commissioner approaches on the dyslexia legislation, we will be getting to that. We're going to go till 11 o'clock, but we will be acting on each of those proposals. I just wanted any of the testifiers that are here, particularly from out of town, we will be getting to that. So thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, just a quick question. Is there anything in statute that would prevent the tribal schools under federal control to move to control by the Department of Education, Minnesota, the state, under state regulations and state funding?
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Claussen, we've talked about that, but there's just a lot of history with the reasons why there are BIE schools and self-determination schools and the relationship. I think that would require a lot more consultation with our BIE schools, with our tribal leaders of those communities, those four communities in which they reside. It seems like that would just be an easy answer, but I think that there are reasons why BIE schools are tribal schools based on historical promises, and I think that the better approach at this point is to do what we can with equalization and do what we can to step up as Minnesotans and put the pressure on our federal partners to step up as well.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thanks. And members, I know we have a number of comments and questions. I think the challenge now is we're going to actively listen as much as we can, particularly that we have so many people from Greater Minnesota. So let's proceed and welcome.
Uju, Joan Lavoie, Indigenous, Gawa Babi Ganikag, Ishkoni Ganig, Indujiba, Waban, Indayan, Makwa, Indundame.
Bonjour.
Hello, Mr. Chair and Senators. My name is Joan Lavoie. I am the Director of Education for the White Earth Nation, and I'm presenting on the following testimony on behalf of Chairwoman Irma Visner, who is in Washington, D.C., working with tribal leaders on the U.S. boarding school policy of 1869 that removed Indian children from their homes. All White Earth Nation education programs and schools strive to provide high-quality services and opportunities for our Indian children from birth through post-secondary. Our goal is to prepare our children for a lifetime of choices, not circumstances. In order to do this, I believe that tribes in the state of Minnesota must continue to work together to strengthen and advance the educational experiences for all American Indian students, educators, and families. It is because of this that I am compelled to present this testimony to you today. The creation of the Tribal Nations Education Committee was endorsed by both Minnesota Indian Minnesota Chippewa Tribe, and the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council in 2007. The Tribal Nations Education Committee consists of representatives from each of the 11 tribes, from the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe, from the metro area and greater Minnesota. Many of the TNEC members are here today. Each year, the Tribal Nations Education Committee prepares a position on education, which outlines priorities in Indian education from birth through post-secondary. Copies of the position paper are here for you to read and use as a guide to making a difference in Indian education in Minnesota. Minnesota was once a leader in Indian education, and by listening to our voices and working together, we can be that leader once again. Increased funding for early childhood programs is vital. Everyone here is aware of the impacts of investing in early childhood programs. Schools, programs, and agencies on the White Earth Reservation provide services to approximately 500 children ages 0 to 5. We have at least another 250, I'm thinking it's closer to 300, not receiving any type of early childhood programming. We ask that you continue to support increased resources for early childhood programs and specifically a new early childhood and tribal communities program. Funded by Minnesota's Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge Grant, the White Earth Early Learning Scholarship Program was designed to ensure that children and families on our reservation have access to high-quality early learning and development care by bridging funding gaps and decreasing barriers. Scholarships were designed to cover the cost of early childhood education, child care, reaching the most at-risk children and families, giving those children opportunities to be kindergarten ready. To date, we have given 168 children scholarships, impacting 118 families. 65 of those children will be without a scholarship as of December 31st, 2015. We ask that you support the necessary funds to hold harmless our current level of funding for the White Earth Early Learning Scholarship Program. I also brought information, and it was given out earlier, on our program. And if you have a few minutes, it would be great if you could take a look at it, see the impacts of our program, and there are great and compelling success stories included within that. Minnesota American Indian students have the highest dropout rate in the nation and the largest achievement gap in comparison to white students in this state. This is not acceptable, and the state of Minnesota must support our schools, teachers, students, and families to increase the achievement rate and outcomes of our Indian students. Minnesota's Success for the Future program is the only state-funded initiative that specifically targets and addresses the needs of American Indian students. The only initiative that addresses the needs of American Indian children is currently a competitive grant. Eligible school districts must apply for these funds, and even though they all need the funds to meet the unique needs of American Indian children, only half of them are awarded. The other half have to wait for 5 years for another chance to apply. Of the 9 eligible school districts on or very near the White Earth Reservation, 4 were awarded funding during its last cycle. We ask that you support increased funding for the Success for the Future program and make it in a formula-driven grant for all eligible school districts. The Minnesota Department of Education revised the academic content of the adult basic education programs in Minnesota through the decision to contract with Pearson VUE Testing Service for the provision of GED testing through the state of Minnesota. The new testing program is known as GED 2014. Since the implementation of the GED 2014 testing program in January of 2014, there has been a dramatic decrease in learner participation at all White Earth adult education study sites. 5 years prior to the GED 2014, we had 199 GED graduates, averaging about 40 per year. Since the change to the GED 2014, we have had 0 graduates. That's a 100% decline. through our sovereign authority on October 6, 2014, the White Earth Reservation Tribal Council passed resolution number 0384007 adopting a HISET exam. It was determined that the HISET exam is an upgrade from the GED 2002, is affordable, and is recognized by the United States Department of Education and is currently utilized in 11 other states. The question that remains to be answered, will our students who pass and take the HISET then qualify for federal financial aid or the Pell Grant? That answer is still waiting for us. It is our request that the state of Minnesota adopt the HISET in lieu of or in addition to the GED 2014 testing program in order for all Minnesota students to be Pell eligible. Circle of Life Academy is a K-12 BIE school on the outskirts of White Earth Village. We have 130 students attending from across the reservation. Our school is underfunded, but we still look for creative and innovative ways to help our students succeed. As the commissioner alluded, total per pupil funding for BIE students is under $7,000 in comparison. Per pupil funding for students in Minnesota's public school is $10,700, or $13,000 for students in Minneapolis. Our BIE students must be funded and treated equally. I am asking that you support an increase in the tribal equalization formula so we can provide the same opportunities and learning environments students and teachers are afforded in schools throughout the state. I do have a copy of the written testimony, which goes into depth and provides some success stories that I would like to have for the record. Miigwech.
Thank you, Ms. LaVoy.
Okay.
Anin Bujou. Suzanne Wise. My Indian name is Ajinangukwe. I am a member of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, and I am here representing Melanie Benjamin, our chief executive from Mille Lacs. Melanie is also in Washington, D.C. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and the members of the committee. The Mille Lacs Band is committed to providing high-quality, culturally-centered educational programming and services to tribal members. We service people from birth throughout their lifetime in terms of higher education. The Mille Lacs Band operates three schools on reservation land. We start off at the age of 6 weeks old at the Waywanubi Early Education Center. Waywanubi was the Indian name of our late chairman, Art Gabo, who some of you may remember. It opened in 2012, and the building was constructed to incorporate the latest renewable energy standards and environmentally friendly features. The Neosheng Lower and High School in Onamia, it provides K-12 education for our tribal members. We currently have 210 students attending Neosheng schools. There is also a charter school operating on the reservation, which is called Minisinaquan Leadership Academy, and that is near McGregor, Minnesota. Minisinaquan is independently operated. Mille Lacs Band families also have the option of sending their children to public schools. We have a high number of Indian students in the Onamia School District, in the Hinckley-Finlayson School District, and McGregor School District. We also have Isle, East Central, and Pine City. As a member of the Tribal Nations Education Committee and in my capacity as the Commissioner of Education for the Mille Lacs Band, I'm here to offer the testimony and support for the 2015 Indian Education Working Group recommendations. These were presented to you today by Dennis and Brenda. For the Mille Lacs Band, we would like to encourage increased funding for the Success for the Future Indian education program. For a lot of the schools that I mentioned, some of them do not even apply for the grants because it's so difficult, and it's the competitiveness of the grant is hard. So some of the school districts that we work with do not even look for the Title VII funding and anything else that they can, which is something that I've reached out to our local superintendents to offer assistance. We would also like to lift the $1,500 cap on per pupil funding in the Bureau of Indian Education Tribal School Equalization Program. We also want to create a new funding stream for early education in tribal communities program. We want to create a provision in the statute to allow for greater flexibility for school boards of the charter schools operating in our tribal communities. We recommend amending the language in the Indian Education Act of 1988 to strengthen the roles and responsibilities of the Indian Education Parent Advisory Committees. Mr. Chair and committee members, there is convincing evidence that high-quality, culturally-centered early education experiences give American Indian children the tools they need to be ready to learn when they begin kindergarten. It is the framework for children to develop strong foundational cognitive skills, develop social and emotional competencies, and to establish patterns of engagement in school and learning. Greater investment in early education programming is essential to improve educational outcomes for our American Indian children. The Tribal Nations Education Committee remains dedicated to our mission to strengthen, protect, and advance the overall educational experience and opportunities for all of American Indian children, students, and families. Thank you for this opportunity to address the committee. Miigwech bizindawiyeg.
Thank you. Chair Papasadora.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Rocky Papasadora. I'm here on behalf of Chair Lady Carrie Jones of the Leech Lake Reservation. I am the chairperson of the tribally operated Bugganegijik School located in Bena, Minnesota, on the Leech Lake Indian Reservation. I have been the chairperson for 8 years and an elected board member since 2000. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today about the educational concerns faced by the Bureau of Indian Education, BIA schools like ours. Today, I'd like to focus my comments on per pupil funding in the BIE school tribal equalization formula. Many of you are aware of the funding discrepancy between the BIE schools and the public schools in Minnesota. As stated by the Commissioner of Education earlier this year, Brenda Casilius, the average per pupil funding in the state of Minnesota is approximately $10,000. Accordingly, the average per pupil funding for students attending BIE schools in Minnesota is $5,000. Currently, the state has a $1,500 funding cap per BIE student in Minnesota. Though the funding is greatly appreciated, a significant financial disparity continues to exist between public schools and the BIE tribal schools. In response to the disparity, I am advocating on behalf of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe for the state of Minnesota to appropriate $2.23 million in fiscal year 2016 and $2.76 million in the fiscal year 2017 to fund students who attend BIE tribal schools by readjusting the per pupil funding formula. If these dollars are secured through legislation, it will lead the way for a just and equitable education for all Minnesota school students. As the chairperson for the BIE Tribal School, I am aware of the educational and social inequities and injustices. that our students, community, and staff face. For instance, our annual budget is contingent upon federal appropriations, which are unpredictable. This directly impacts our ability to plan. Yet despite the unique circumstances that our school confronts, we are one of a few schools that offer a great culture and language program to all of our students. Students and their families who choose to attend the Bugganegijik School are assured they will learn the Ojibwe traditions, cultures, history, and language. Our staff that choose to work for the school is assured family membership. As the chairperson, I am assured that the Ojibwe culture and language will live forever. And our Native American students will be equipped with essential knowledge and skills to survive into the 21st century. In conclusion, our Bugganegijik school students should have equal access to highly qualified administrators and teachers, reliable technology, and a safe and secure school without having to compromise their right to a quality education due to the lack of funding. Therefore, I am supporting increasing per pupil funding in the BIE Tribal School Equalization Formula. Thank you ever so much. And with that, Chairman, member of the committee, I conclude my statement. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Papasadora. And at this point, I would ask any of the tribal leaders if they would like to come behind or join at the table with the commissioner as well as students, and at least so we can see everyone. And we perhaps have a few more minutes before we get to the next segment of the meeting, but if any of the tribal leaders or students would like to make a brief statement, we would entertain that. And again, we appreciate the thoughtful recommendations that have gone into this report. And Commissioner, I'll let you direct traffic. Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question or comment to Ms. Lavoie before she stands. You were talking about the GED program. I'm just wondering, another option that the legislature passed recently was the adult diploma program, and that might be another option to look at as you work with clients.
Mr. Chair and Senator Clausen, yes, that is something that we are looking at, but 90% of our students that go through the GED program are older than what the adult diploma would allow them to do. So we do really need to take a look at reforming or adding the HISET or another test as an option.
That's why I wanted the most.
Instead of the GED 2014.
Thank you.
Miigwech.
Yes, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senators, the adult diploma program we are just now launching off the ground. It just recently passed. We're piloting in a few, and we haven't gone full scale yet statewide with the adult diploma program.
Commissioner, could we have each of the others just join us, introduce themselves, with your name and where you're from? And it's not necessary to, give a speech.
Okay. My name is Billy Annette, and I work with the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe. I'm from the White Earth Nation. I grew up on the Red Lake Indian Reservation, and I now work on the Leech Lake Reservation. I appreciate, and I'm intimidated being here. I wasn't expecting to say anything, but since I have the mic, two things I'd like to say.
Okay.
Curriculum needs to be adjusted to be inclusive of Indian history, and Indian history belongs to all of us. I think everybody should know there would be a stronger mutual respect if we knew about each other a bit more. And the other, I forgot what the other thing is, but yes, I do remember. Tribal Nation Education Committee, I'm the secretary on that committee, and I think it would be beneficial if at some point we could meet here someplace and invite you to our meeting, and then invite you as well to come and meet with us at some point in time. Miigwech.
Thank you. This is voluntary, but yeah, who would like?
Hello there. I should say, ha matakwiapioisen. We're all related. I'm Dr. Tiffany Beckman. I'm from the University of Minnesota, enrolled member of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. I'm not here to represent anybody, actually, except what you're talking about, which is Indian education. I wouldn't be here today had we not had a strong education system, at least somewhere in the state. So I'm here trying to help the next generations with this. I do think the Bugganikishig school needs a serious facelift. It's freezing in there. I don't know that it's been renovated in quite a long time. So one of our formal tribal leaders, Mike Bongo, asked me to come here and straighten this out. He's passed away recently, but that happens. You know, we all go to the spirit world at some point. Anyway, Chi Miigwech.
Thank you, Doctor.
Bonjour, I'm Danielle Grant. I'm the Director of Indian Education with Minneapolis Public Schools, and I'm a part of the task force representing the needs of our urban Indian students. We have over 1,800 American Indian students in Minneapolis Public Schools, and it's my responsibility to look out for their needs. So happy to be here this morning.
Thank you.
Bonjour, my name is Darwin Sumner. I'm from Red Lake. I'm a school board member, and I'm here to support Mr. Papasador and the rest of the panel you had here. We have 1,700 students in Red Lake School District, and 95% are American Indian. One of the things I want to put a bug in your ear about is the Indian Teacher Training Program. We'd like to see the funds double for that if possible. So, very good. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Committee, my name is Ricky White is my English name. I'm the proud executive director of a charter school right here in Minneapolis, Augsburg Fairview Academy. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Indian Education Association. And one thing I wanted to say is a connection. There's our ancestors who probably sat at this table with members of the ancestry of this committee hundreds of years ago and likely said the same things in the tongue of our people. And unfortunately, we can't go back across the great waters and relive our culture and our language and the ways of our people. We can't go back to Germany and learn German. Can't go back to Scotland and learn Scottish ancestry. It's here. This is where we've always been. And I believe what's being put forth on the table here today is another initiative, another historic day, much like how our treaties were signed in our nations here, that this is another historic day to initiate that kind of support for Indian education for all. Jimmy, what you keep is enjoying him. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Gertrude Bucknaga, and I've been involved in Indian education since about 1968. I've been in school since I was 3 years old. I found that out when I was in graduate school. I'm also a survivor of a boarding school, and I was invited here by Irma Visner because I live in Minneapolis, and I'm an off-reservation member. I'm a member of the White Earth Nation, and my family is have been involved in education for a long time, the Bucknaga family, boys. And I live in the urban area in Minneapolis, and I'd like to make a presentation on the Indian children that are not being counted. The BIA system has a way of counting Indians, and they have to be enrolled in a tribe. And in Minneapolis, I work with a multicultural Indian community, where they're made up of, say, Leech Lake and White Earth, Leech Lake and Red Lake, White Earth and Fond du Lac. And I have great-grandchildren that are enrolled in Red Lake, Fond du Lac, White Earth, Leech Lake. So I have family members that are connected to all the reservations, including the Dakota Reservation. My granddaughter, next year, her father's Standing Rock Indian, her mother's White Earth Indian, and she's going to marry a Potawatomi. So we're going to have several different tribal groups in our family. And we have a number of Indian children in Minneapolis that are not being counted. And I just kind of estimated here that we have about, like, in Minneapolis gets about 13,000 per child. And I counted 2,000 Indians here, but there's probably more than that. And I thought Minneapolis gets $26 million for every for the Indian students that are attending school there. And many of the staff are employed through the Title VII program, Title IV. So we don't have Indian teachers in the system. We have very few. The 1250, the Board of Education, is about a block and a half from where I work. And I enrolled some of my great-grandchildren in school, and there was not one Indian person at 1207. The system's kind of bureaucratic. You have to register first at 1250, then you have to go to the schools to register.
We appreciate your comments. Right now we can only have introductions.
Well, I just think you need to know about a number of Indian students that are not being counted.
We appreciate that.
And number of them. But I'll write up the things here that I have to do, and because we're concerned about the high dropout rate, the charter school system, and how we're not being recognized through these systems. The systems are very bureaucratic. I'll write it up so you make sure you have a copy of what I see that are barriers.
We would appreciate that. To the extent something is not covered by the recommendations, please, you're encouraged to provide that. Thank you.
Morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Bonjour, Anishinaabe, Dakota, Indana, Nuwamanadug. My name is Vince Bile. I'm the Director of Indian Education for Bemidji Public Schools, where I've been for 29 years. I want to share with you, it's truly been an honor and a privilege to be working in education. We are one of the recipients of the Success for the Future grant and some of the testimony you've heard here this morning. I can assure you that the 66 public schools in the state of Minnesota, where only 27 are currently funded under those monies, have the same needs, the same issues as us. The opening remarks about Minnesota being last in this country is a tragedy, to be truthful. It's almost nations at risk. And these monies that we refer to as Success for the Future, the grant, along with the Indian Education Act of 1988 that took place with the scholarships and so forth, has been a great resource for us to work collectively in school districts, whether it be public schools, tribal schools, BIA. Our Indian students, whether they're homeschooled, chartered schooled, BIA schools, public, they're still our students, and they're at risk when the test scores reflect that as such. The increase proposed for the Success for the Future grant would help curb that achievement gap that lacks in the state, and I can assure you that not one penny, not one taxpayer's dollar would be wasted if that grant or if that formula was increased. It's unfortunate that the grant has been competitive and that if you don't have a grant writer, you're out of the luck, but your needs are the same. And I think it's wise under the leadership of the commissioner, the Tribal Nations Committee, the Indian Nations that have been in consultation to propose that those other outlying schools get the fair and equity amount to be able to move ahead and address this achievement gap. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hoiani Washday. My name is Paul Dressen. I'm the education director for the Prairie Island Dakota Nation. And I think at this point, everything is that's been said that our Dakota Nation supports. It has to be Indian education for all, and it starts with being able to fund our programs, our departments, our liaison, supporting our local Indian Education Committee, and we need school districts and superintendents and teachers to listen to our concerns, because we are the best resource as far as how our kids are going to be successful in a public school setting. Adamia.
Oh, thank you.
My name is Beth Tepper. I'm the education director for Shakopee Mittawakaton Sioux Community, and I just wanted to say thank you for this opportunity. Our students are spread out over 32 different schools just in our reservation. They go to many public, charter, private schools, and one of the important things that the Shakopee Mittawakaton Sioux Community has focused on is the language, the Dakota language, and the preservation of the culture of the community and the history. And there's always a gap when we have our students attending public schools or charter, it doesn't matter, when it comes to learning about the Dakota people. And when the social studies standards come up, it seems that teachers in schools are always looking for support from someone from the community to come out and teach. So the children and the teachers in the public schools are hungry for that knowledge. And I just think this is a beginning to come around that. And I'd like to see more teachers, principals, and superintendents who are Native American and can bring that perspective into the public school system.
Thank you. We have just two more minutes.
My name is Billy Mace, and I'm the Commissioner of Education for Boys Sport. We're located up in northern Minnesota. And I just wanted to point out the drastic contrast that was mentioned in the previous hearing about Minnesota being one of the top in nation in education, and what the comments you're hearing now about the state of Indian education in Minnesota. I'd also like to, because of a rural location and the services that we have seen through Dennis's office, we would also, in the future, I would like to see the offices reopened up in Midgey and up in Duluth. I've been in my position as commissioner for the last 15 years. I'm also a member of the Tribal Nations Education Committee, and I wanted to thank you for hearing the words of everyone that has spoken today, and thank you for your consideration and support of everything that was presented. Thank you.
Thanks. Hanawash Day. My name is Jackie Prescott Probst, and as a member of the Lower Sioux Indian community, I support and serve our students down in Redwood Valley, southwest corner of the state. We are a recipient of the Success for the Future funds, and as our students are about 25 to 30% of our school district, I just have to say that my first year with our students about 11 years ago, we had 2 Native American graduates. This spring, we're looking at 15. And I have to applaud that. I'm grateful for that, and I have to say thank you to MDE and all of their support. So please, it's a need, and we appreciate your support.
Okay. Commissioner, we have to go. We have many people for our next part of the meeting. So if we could just get an introduction, we can have another hearing on this. But for those that would like to at least share their name. Okay. And I believe the students all had to leave to go back to school. But we want to acknowledge their participation. And, Commissioner, we thank you for your leadership and putting together the task force recommendations. May it provide inspiration, hope, as we further deliberate this significant challenge. So thank you. Thank you to all the testifiers and others that came here today for this very historic event. And
Mr. Chairs, Senators, I just want to thank you again. We're taking a long view here. Just much like pre-K, we're building a foundation. We're building our future. And I don't want to be 5 years, 10 years down the line saying, wish that we had done it when we had a surplus and we were able to do it. So thank you so much for your consideration. Thank you for your respect in hearing other testifiers. Very much appreciated. And I know it will mean a lot to everybody moving forward. So very appreciative.
Thank you, Commissioner Casellas. Senator Chamberlain, thank you for your patience, and we'll now go to Senate Files 271 and 278. As I mentioned earlier, we will go up to 11 o'clock if necessary, and we'll ask you, Senator Chamberlain, to bring your testifiers. All of them will have a chance to testify as needed. We'll wait for 1 minute as the room transitions. And I'll assume we have any of the handouts that are necessary for 271 and 278.
Okay. Is there a, we have the handouts? Okay.
Yep. Okay. You're here for 271 and 278. We're ready. And please gather around.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Chamberlain.
Okay, I believe Senator Chamberlain is right outside the door.
How are you?
And I know that Rachel Berger and others that are going to be testifying, but as soon as he's here, we'll introduce the subject on dyslexia and acknowledge that it's your day at the Capitol. Okay. Yes, could staff please? And Senator Chamberlain, we'll take the bills in whatever order you'd like, and it's yours. To all the students and other visitors for the first time, welcome to your state capitol.
Sit on that chair.
And we'll I'll keep the door open. I think everybody is entering that
We're
wishes
them
to.
Off, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Chamberlain. Again,
let me go ahead and get started.
Yes. We have before us Senate File 271. Senator Chamberlain, would you like to start with that?
Yes. 271 is the reading credit. And kind of a quick summary. First, thanks for hearing us again, Mr. Chair. And we did discuss this bill somewhat last year. We did get something in statute, but we have to come back, revisit it, to continue the effort for these families and the kids. So thank you for that. I appreciate the discussion last year. and we will try to get this in as quickly as possible. Our kind of group these two together, there's three different things we're going to be talking about. Definition of dyslexia, we're going to address the literacy piece, and then the reading credit issue in that order. The reading credit, well, the
yes.
reading credit will be first, okay?
Yes.
And we won't get too much into details. We'll talk about the policy behind the reading credit, if that's your desire.
Okay? Yes, and then ultimately it would go to taxes with the implication there.
All right. So with that, I guess, brief introduction, I'll introduce Rachel Berger. She has been with us, working with us in the group for quite a long time, but she'll go into that.
Thank you, Sarah Chamberlain. Welcome back, Ms. Berger.
Thank you. First, I know that you guys have had a long morning here, and you've heard a couple of different things, and I just want to mention briefly, and I know you've been talking about vision, and I want to mention that we're here to discuss dyslexia, and while there are some children with dyslexia who may have vision issues, this is a separate issue we're discussing here today.
Yes.
Just want to keep that in mind. So I'm not sure what information you guys have had before, but I'll try to be brief here. About 45 million Americans struggle with dyslexia. Dyslexia is a language-based learning disability. That makes about 1 in 5 in our population who struggle with this. And that might sound high, and that might sound shocking to you, probably because it's invisible. But it doesn't make it makes it harder to diagnose, but no less pervasive. And as a parent, I can tell you that the millions of children who struggle to read, this is very real and very painful. I could tell you as a parent, it's a very lonely and isolating path to try to navigate our educational system, to find an education for your child that more often than not denies our kids the right to an education that actually works for them. A group of us has come together, and we're here, and we thank you for allowing us to be here. We're here to shed light on this issue and to help you to understand how we can help these children in Minnesota. So we're a group of parents whose mission is to help implement change in Minnesota for all children who are struggling with literacy, specifically representing our children with dyslexia. And while we're here today to discuss the local literacy policy as well as the tax credit, we do have goals in the future to help these children to be able to continue to have a better outcome in our state educational system.
Thank you. Yes, please proceed. We'll
so we have a few people here who would like to speak. I'd like to bring up some of our young adults who struggle with this disability, and I guess I'm not sure if I'm supposed to announce them or you would like to.
I have several on the agenda, and I if you'd like to announce them, or I can, Jody Smith, Michaela Smith, Nick Keller are listed as students.
And for the kids to do.
I see there's more than just three.
So we'll go with this young man first, and we'll bring up Michaela.
Okay.
And
for the tape, just before you testify with your statement, indicate your name and where you're from.
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Nick Keller, and I am dyslexic. Before I was diagnosed with dyslexia, the public school system was a miserable place for me, and I have many memories of that. And also, working sometimes with kids that would understand and get things, I'd work 10 times harder with them with no result. And some teachers would consider this a lack of trying when I was trying my hardest. And that drive really drove me to want to try harder. And so I was miserable. At fifth grade, my parents were getting desperate. Before my mom found out a different approach. Being a high school teacher, she got involved with the Norton Gillingham program, which was a different approach to how the public schools approach dyslexia in the public school system. My parents and my mom were getting desperate, and the special ed programs that I was a part of were just giving me the answers and were just sliding me along. And I was not about to let that happen to myself, nor was my parents. After being frustrated, in fifth grade, halfway through fifth grade, my mom pulled me out to be homeschooled and be given this approach. Working an hour and a half to 2 hours a day with this approach, she was able to take me from a first grade reading level in fifth grade and have me at reading at level in 5 weeks and at a fifth grade reading level. And so it's just the approach to how we approach dyslexia, the being smart. It's not, you have to be smart in order to be dyslexic. Otherwise, you can't consider yourself dyslexic. it's just the way it is. And so, but I was looked at as dumb in my school, which really lowered my self-esteem. In seventh grade, my parents put me back in the public school system. I tested out of the special ed, the same special ed program that they said the school said I would never come out of, and I'd graduate with that special ed program. But I tested out of it in seventh grade after approach of being homeschooled for a year and a half. My self-esteem level shot up through the roof. I was confident in classrooms, and kids started looking at me, asking me for help, and they're like, I can't believe you were this smart when we were in elementary. Okay. I just looked, and I was like, I had that approach. And it was just so, it's the kids, and I had was very successful in high school. When I was on the honor roll program, I made school board scholar. I worked for it. And with just that one approach of different approach of learning, I graduated at the top 5% of my high school class. And looking back at it, I just still see all those kids that were sitting in that same special ed program just like I was, disrupted, did not have the self-confidence. Their self-esteem was nothing. And they did not have enough self-esteem, enough drive, because the teachers did not believe them, that they weren't trying, they couldn't do it. And it was just a lack of motivation. Right now, I went to school for heating and air conditioning at Southeast Technical. And at 20 years old, I'm working at the Metropolitan Airports Commission at the International Airport to just heat and cooling their buildings. And I consider myself a success.
And so do we.
And I just want to just say, the kids that were in that same special ed program are just still disrupted today with a lack of self-esteem that they have for themselves. And some of them have ended up in jail, and I wish I could have been there to have them, just to give them the right approach. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cobb.
I'd like to call up Michaela Smith.
Okay.
Sorry.
Welcome, Ms. Smith.
Hi. So, hi. I'm Michaela Smith. Yeah. I'm dyslexic. Yep. I was born and raised here in St. Paul, and I was in the public schools here. I was trying very hard to learn to read, but something wasn't clicking. By the time I was in second grade, I felt I would never learn to read or write. And I can't emphasize enough how hard that feels on a second grader when everybody around you is just excelling. Finally, I was diagnosed with dyslexia at the beginning of second grade. It was hard for kids who have invisible disabilities, like dyslexia, because our disability is too often misunderstood. I still have professors now, and I go to Concordia University to become a teacher, actually. And still professors have the misinterpretation that, oh, the words move around on the page for you. Is that what it is? And it's not. That's not for me. That's not what happened for me. So every day in second grade, though, a child was chosen to write a word, the words of the day and the month. It was meant to be a challenge, so the other kids weren't allowed to help. And one day, my teacher asked me to do it. And at the level I was not ready. And I was already in special ed, and my special ed teacher advised my teacher not to have me do these activities because I wasn't at that level yet. She called me up, and she told me to write the words, which were walk and bread, things like that. And the month was February. And I still cannot spell February unless I look at a calendar. this was way too advanced for me in second grade. So I was only just learning to read at this time. So I was not able to do the task. And I stood there for 15 minutes in front of the board just staring at it and crying because I couldn't do it. I still think about it today because I was so humiliated. And my friends were there, and they wanted to help me, and they couldn't because they knew that was the rules. And this happened because my teacher was, she did not understand what dyslexia was, and I had to deal with that. And I had to deal with it later on, different things such as that, but that one stuck with me to this day, and I'm a freshman in college. Though I was diagnosed at an early age, I did not learn to read until fifth grade. That was the first time I read a full chapter book by myself, and it took me, I want to say, like 6 months, and a lot of time, extra help, but I wanted to do it, and I did it, and I'm still proud of myself about that, actually. Our schools are not set up to help dyslexic kids. I've been told to get tutored by teachers before, and my family comes from a low-income family. I can't afford that. It was not an option for our family. My mom did everything she could. If it wasn't for her, I would not be in college today. But tutoring was not an option for my family. Even though I was lucky and diagnosed at an early age, I still struggled with reading and had teachers who still didn't believe dyslexia was real. And it was a very hard struggle for me on account that, you know, someone tells you you're dyslexic and the people you look up to and are supposed to teach you don't know what it is or misinterpret it and try to help you, but just think of you as not trying hard enough. And you're trying your absolute hardest. Dyslexia is real. We need to acknowledge it and help our teachers out to understand it. They need the needs of students who invisibly struggle with it. And as wanting to become a teacher myself, I want to make sure that even teachers who aren't special ed teachers in elementary school teachers, they should be going to school so they know what dyslexia is because it doesn't go away. You still struggle with it every day, but you make the best of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Smith.
Mr. Chair. If you'd like, we have just one more brief testimony, and then I could sum up these bills briefly for you and go through them, if that would be okay.
Senator Chamberlain, and there can be others, you know, following the description as to their support as well. But we'll proceed with whoever you'd like to have next.
Thank you.
Okay. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Amy Schulting, and I wear many different hats in the world of dyslexia. I'm a former K-12 classroom teacher, and I primarily taught grades K through 3. I have a master's degree in education and a principal license. I also have a PhD in clinical psychology, where I have two roles currently. I am currently a research scientist at Duke University in education policy, and locally I'm in private practice as a psychologist here in the Twin Cities.
However, I think you're qualified.
Thank you. Many years. But most importantly, the reason that I'm here today is because I'm the mother of three young boys with dyslexia who, like so many others, are not having their academic needs met in our public schools. So briefly, I just want to tell you, when my first son struggled to learn to read, I was shocked that his school did not provide, as you heard testimony already, that his school did not provide appropriate assessment or intervention for him. So I sought an outside evaluation and determined that he has dyslexia. But when I brought this information to the school, I was mystified when I was told that they don't use the word dyslexia and that they don't recognize it. So I now hear this same story every day from families in my clinical practice, and I have to say my heart breaks each time I hear these stories because virtually every family has almost the same exact story. They tell us that they had early concerns about their child's reading difficulties, but they were told that it would click. They were told that their child would grow out of it or that pull-out services would help, but it didn't. And we've known about dyslexia since the late 1800s. An effective intervention has been around for almost 100 years. And yet the 1 in 5 students who struggle with dyslexia in our schools continue to be denied proper identification and services. And as you can imagine, not learning to read has devastating consequences. Dyslexic students are more likely to drop out of high school if they do graduate. Very few attend four-year universities because the vast majority of struggling readers in third grade do not go on to college. But it doesn't have to be this way. As our first young man told you, dyslexics are smart, and by definition, the disorder of dyslexia requires an average to above average or even genius IQ. These are highly talented people who can make strong contributions to society if they learn to read, and they deserve to learn to read. So I'm absolutely thrilled to be here with you today to finally address this important issue for all children. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you. And members of the audience, normally we don't have applause. We're waiving that today. So.
Mr. Chair, what we'd like to do is I'll give a one-minute overview of these two pieces. What's that?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I have found this testimony really valuable. And I think when people come and they've made this kind of effort to be here and you have given us graciously a little more time, I would like to at least have the other testifiers on the list here have an opportunity to at least speak a few words as we have been gracious to others as well. If we could do that,
thank you,
Senator, and Senator Chamberlain, thank if you. You would go ahead and call your others to come up.
Thank you. Appreciate
thank
that.
You.
Thank you, Mr.
No,
Chair.
No, Senator Kiffmeyer, I had suggested that earlier.
What's that one? Right. No. Was I being dyslexic?
Yes. Okay. It's
funny. It's funny.
My name is Aminina Abdul-Rashid, and I am a freshman at Century High School in Rochester, Minnesota, and I, too, am dyslexic. I found out that I had dyslexia at the end of sixth grade when I failed a social studies multiple choice test that was in the format of a Scantron. And the very next hour, my teacher gave me the same exact test but allowed me to write on the test in an essay format. And I aced it. The teacher called my mom and said she couldn't believe it. And I just thought, well, duh. It's a Scantron test. I told my mom for more than 3 years prior that I had a writing problem and I couldn't identify what it was. And she didn't think I was dyslexic because I didn't flip my letters around on the paper when I wrote. Well, that's what she thought dyslexia was, flipping letters. I did flip letters sometimes in my head, but I just couldn't explain that at the time. And I couldn't get the information in my head transferred down onto the paper or even verbally. Teachers told my parents that I was smart, but I wasn't paying attention, or that I wasn't applying myself, or sometimes they even suggested that I would need glasses, but I could see fine. My parents were also frustrated that I couldn't do things quickly because they knew I was smart. After I went to the Reading Center for testing, my pediatrician recommended that I go to the Educational Development Center at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. There, I learned that I actually have a really nice IQ and that I'm not cognitively impaired. I just need extra time, a workspace free of distractions, and a testing format that doesn't require transferring information in multiple places. My mom went to school to ask for a 504 plan for me when I entered the seventh grade. The guidance counselor for me said that they, in order to get a 504 plan for me, they would need to check a box that said that I had a significant mental impairment that prevents me from learning. Checking this box was the only way my parents could get me any help, said the guidance counselor. And that checkbox didn't make me feel very well. And they wouldn't even let me put dyslexia on the 504 plan. I'm not mentally impaired or disabled, and I just learned differently. I have to spend more time on my reading and writing assignments than most kids, but few at middle school seem to understand that. I was teased and bullied by my classmates, and I even had a classmate whose dad is a brain surgeon tell me that I'm developmentally disabled, that I would never be smart, never be what I wanted to be, and that I probably wouldn't even graduate high school. This was right in front of the teacher, and the teacher did nothing about it. Teachers even told me that they didn't have time to help students like me because my grades were okay, meaning that I was passing, that they were mediocre. They have to help people who are behind on their grades and even if they're going to give out extra time at all. I felt like the teachers weren't there to give me the needs that to be the best that I could be. They were focused on getting kids to a minimum level, and that seems to be the way the school system works. I'm not sure if the teachers were telling me that they don't have time for me so I could plan on getting left behind too, or that if that is their way of saying that they don't like the way the system works either, but their hands were tied. After I found out I was dyslexic at the end of sixth grade, I got on a waiting list for a tutor with the Reading Center. We waited from June to November until I got one, so that's 6 months. My parents paid for my Reading Center tutor at their own expense so I could learn essential skills, the Orton-Gillingham method as mentioned earlier, and to compensate for what I'm not getting at school. I am lucky that they can pay for this for me and will pay for this for me because I know all kids can't have that chance. At school, teachers have embarrassed me, asking me in front of everyone to talk loudly to see if I understood what they were teaching or to read a passage out loud or even map out my thoughts on the process, thought process on the board so they can sit or criticize it publicly. And that made me feel hopeless, frustrated, and I lost my motivation after a while. And I didn't want the fact that I was dyslexic advertised everywhere, but the teachers I had couldn't seem to be discreet about my 504 plan and accommodations. I hope that you will create laws that help parents and their children more easily and affordably, and I hope that you will create an educational system that ensures that each child becomes the best student that he or she can be without having to struggle so much. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for your courage, your determination, your perseverance.
Mr. Chair, we just have two more right now. Jody.
Stanton.
Stanton. Yes.
And Senator Chamberlain, we'd probably like to entertain motions at about 10:58.
Yeah, what time is it now?
9 minutes.
10:52. If we were to take action today.
All right. Yes. Thank you. Okay. Yeah,
thank you.
We'll do that.
Welcome.
Good morning. My name is Jody Smith. I'll just start with my story. As far back as I can remember, school was always a constant source of pain for me. First grade was the first time that a teacher made me feel like I was stupid because I didn't understand a simple assignment of matching. By fourth grade, I knew I was different from my peers. I didn't know why or what made me different, but I was aware of my lack of reading and writing skills. I felt like I was so far behind all of my classmates. They were reading chapter books while I was lagging behind reading much simpler material. My teachers had no idea what was really plaguing me. They presumed that my struggles were from a lack of trying. Because I didn't know why I was different, the easiest way to explain it to myself was that I was stupid. And if I could label myself stupid, I can only wonder what others thought. At the age of 25, I was finally given my label of dyslexia. Prior to this, I went back and forth whether to get tested or not, because I questioned whether being formally diagnosed with dyslexia would be beneficial for me at 25. Well, to this day, I can without a doubt say that being diagnosed with dyslexia was the best day of my life. Without the label of dyslexia, I didn't know how to explain my struggles to read, write, and spell. And I didn't deserve to think I was stupid up until I was 25. Not only was it difficult for me to understand why I struggled, but my teachers didn't understand either. Throughout my K through 12 experience, I never had one teacher acknowledge my struggles in reading, writing, and spelling. Without a definition of dyslexia in our state code, most teachers are unaware of what dyslexia is. Just a couple weeks ago, I witnessed a third grade teacher telling her students that dyslexia is when you see things backwards. And we all know that that is not the truth. Without my label of dyslexia, I had no confidence in myself and I had no hope of ever feeling worthy. With my dyslexia label, I became a confident and hopeful that I could succeed at great things. Now that I finally understood myself, I went from being a D average high school student to a 4.0 college student. Because with the label of dyslexia, I now understand how I learn best and the ways to accommodate my needs. If a student struggles to read, write, and spell, they too deserve the opportunity to know if it is dyslexia or not. What they don't deserve is to be labeled a struggling reader, not achieving at grade level, or learning disabled. But let's call it what it is, dyslexia. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hagedorn. Jan Hagedorn.
Okay. Ms. Hagedorn? Rochester, and thank you for your patience. And
I wasn't expecting to get to talk.
Here we are. Patience is bitter. Its fruit is sweet.
And it's very short.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
But I'm coming at this from a different perspective. My name is Jan Hagedorn. I work at the Reading Center in Rochester. The Reading Center is a not-for-profit center that was started in 1961. We're considered one of the premier trainers of Orton-Gillingham tutors and teachers, as well as working with people that have dyslexia using the Orton-Gillingham approach. We have known for generations, literally, that there's a void that exists between teacher knowledge and what we know about dyslexia. And we have tried at the Reading Center to patch that gap best that we could, at least by trying to implement some training programs for teachers that are already in the system, that are already working with kids, as well as some legislation that we know that you've brought about to help with teacher training earlier. But it's important for you to know that our population comes from all backgrounds. In Rochester, 35% of our students are on scholarships. So it doesn't matter what language you speak, whether you're rich or poor, dyslexia goes across all of those barriers and across all the lines. We've collaborated with the Mayo Clinic for some studies, and we've definitively been able to show that there is a genetic component to dyslexia, which means that it's something that's organic as well as something that's unseen. And we certainly know that with the right kind of education, such as Orton-Gillingham or something that's similar, that readers can become productive, successful adults. Too often at the Reading Center, we see teens and children that have given up on themselves, and that's not necessary. With the right teaching approach, which is different than working in small groups getting the same approach again, which is what seems to be happening in the system right now, that it's never too late to help for services. So, you know, we are, I guess, begging that with the right approaches, we'll diminish some of the other problems with helping struggling readers.
Thank you, Ms. Hagedorn. And Senator Chamberlain, on your first Senate file, 271, this is for the reading credit to increase from 2,000 to 3,000. I believe there's a legislative study, a report for March of 2016 regarding utilization. That said, this still would go to tax committee and to review that. And is there anyone opposed to Senate file 271? Senator Chamberlain moves that Senate file 271 be recommended.
278 and 359? 359 is the reading credit, is that correct?
271 is the reading tax credit. And if that's okay, Senator Chamberlain, I'm going to.
Silly me. All right, yes.
Entertain a motion from you to move approval and that it be re referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion? All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried on the reading tax credit. And now before us is Senate File 278, where we've had a great deal of foundation on the need for literacy plans. I'll very humbly, respectfully point out this is not optional. This would be a mandate to the local district.
Mr. Chair.
But that said, I'm with you.
With that said, Mr. Chair, thank you for pointing that out. My view of it is they're already composing these plans and they're creating the data and collecting it. It'd be a simple matter to take that one step further and complete the process. But I appreciate you pointing that out. The literacy plan is kind of fill some holes, create some consistency in the current literacy plan. To help recognize and identify these the kids that would have dyslexia. And it also has a component there that if the schools don't comply with the requirement to put the districts and the schools put the plan on the website, their literacy aid would be withheld. So there is that component of it.
Thank you, Senator Chamberlain. I'd ask if Ms. Kelleher wants a statement for the record on this before we have it laid over for possible inclusion. Ms. Kelleher? Representing the Minnesota School Boards Association.
Mr.
Chairman and members, Grace Kelleher with the Minnesota School Boards Association. And we do have concerns about this Senate File 278, in particular the expansion of the plan to cover dyslexia. We're concerned also about the definition. We'd like our special ed folks to take a look at it. We want to make sure it's written, you know, sort of in the special ed code we've got going forward. We are concerned there's no additional revenue with this, and also think if you're going to go this way, Mr. Chairman and members, you need to consider autism this way. You need to think about ADD and ED children all wanting sort of their special spot. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate your time and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sir Chamberlain, we have your commitment to work with the MSBA and other interested stakeholders.
We will continue the effort, but Amy would have one comment regarding
yes.
that. We make the commitment.
Ms. Schulte.
My comment is just regarding the children with ADHD and autism, and about 1 in 9, or 9% of kids are diagnosed with ADHD, and 1 in 68, which is less than 2% of autism. And actually, there are categories within special ed, and I'm not a special education expert, but I know that there are categories within special ed for educational autism. So it is called autism within the schools, and schools do call it ADHD, and they categorize it as other health impaired. And so our concern is the term dyslexia is not used, even though children clearly have dyslexia and are receiving reading help and are given a label of reading disability, but it's not called dyslexia. So I just wanted to make that point.
Thank you.
One further point, Ms. Berger.
I support what Amy says, and we will make the commitment to working with the education as she was suggesting, but at the same rate, if I might so boldly say, I don't believe that our public schools are experts on dyslexia and a definition of, and we have attempted to work with them to put things into rules and regulations serving the dyslexic population. As thus, that has not happened so far. That's why we're here today, and we are here representing these students to make sure that they are not continued to go back into those classrooms and remain invisible to this population.
Yeah. I'd like to, on behalf of the committee, thank everybody for your patience, for being here, for the excellent presentations. We have the commitment of the author to continue working on this bill with others that have expressed some suggestions. And with that said, Senator Chamberlain moves that Senate File 278 be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Further discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If not, all in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Senator Chamberlain, thank you very much. Thank you, members, for going overtime. And our next meeting will be tomorrow with the agenda as noted. Please adjourn.
It's a strategy they're using that session to wait.
Possible doesn't mean for sure because we know what happened.